Yeah, the eyeballs. The eyeballs.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
Today we're going to talk about Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, and The Substance, starting with the Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice movie. Be careful not to say that three times, Mike. Can it be possible that the original came out 36 years ago?
That's quite amazing. But as we know, Hollywood is very interested in recycling. And you know, I'm all for recycling. And so in their case, creatively, sometimes they reach back a bit. In this case, it is quite striking, as you say. You know, the first Beetlejuice came out in 1988. It's been that long. So I almost don't want to think about that too much. But, you know, at the risk of saying the title three times, we go from Beetlejuice to Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. So there, I've jinxed myself already. Who knows what will happen in the next few minutes. And in this case, you know, I'm not a huge fan of that kind of creative recycling for the most part. To me, it oftentimes just seems exploitative in the sense of taking a known property and just working it and working it and reworking it endlessly. But this is a somewhat different case in that we're not talking about a franchise here where they just keep working the material over and over again. This is, you know, Tim Burton himself. And so I'll make a partial allowance if I'm judge and jury here, a partial allowance that in his case, when he goes back to a film he made so many years ago, his sensibilities remain much the same. And that's not a problem, actually, because he has a visual cleverness that oftentimes keeps you engaged with it. So although I wasn't exactly thrilled with the film, at the level of what I call eye candy appeal, it's constantly popping one way or another with things to hold your attention. So I know that seems rather mild or tepid by way of praise, but I think that, you know, the film is amusing and it can be kind of aimless, and it does meander and this and that, but it's got a very watchable cast. It's got some terrific special effects, even by our kind of jaded special effects standards. It has some really neat stuff in it. And you know what? You could do a lot worse. So how's that for a backhanded
compliment? You know, it kind of reminded me of going to a high school reunion where you ran into a bunch of people you'd forgotten about, but you're like, oh yeah, that person, or I remember that character. They did a great job of bringing back a lot of people from the original movie. I mean, Winona Ryder looks great. Every time Michael Keaton is on screen, he's hilarious. But I think the stroke of genius was, you know, having all of those little moments like, you know, Danny DeVito playing a janitor in the afterlife, that kind of thing. I think the stroke of genius was casting Jenna Ortega as the young daughter of Winona Ryder's character, because she's so familiar to people from the Netflix series Wednesday, which gives it that, you know, goth credibility right there. And it makes that kind of fun because it's sort of blending two spooky worlds into one. But I will say, Monica Bellucci was just wasted in this. They didn't really give her enough to do, and they just turned her into a caricature. That was the only character I thought was really a miss.
Well, you know, you point to an interesting problem, if you will, namely that the whole thing is borderline caricature. It's a matter of how far to push it. And there are times where I feel that the film itself is just pushing too hard, trying too hard that way. And that's why, you know, my feeling for the film, although it's positive, is not enthusiastic. And one of the reasons why it's tempered is what you just said. Monica Bellucci, again, visually, you know, it's great casting that way. She looks the part, but you get this kind of, you know, monstrous live action cartoon quality to it. And it may be funny if the first few times, and then it just seems like really forced and also really arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And I think this is to your point that the film itself is kind of scattershot. And I think the sort of ramshackle storyline is something that we're familiar with from the first Beetlejuice. Here, it's perhaps even more ramshackle in the sense that when she pops up, it's like, oh, well, here she is again. And then 2 minutes later, she's off and something else pops on. And it's almost as if, you know, we don't have much of an attention span. So it engages us for 10 seconds and then we jump to something else for 10 seconds. So I think it's actually emblematic of my major reservation about this film in particular, or this type of film in general. It's just that somehow, you know, I want something a little more cohesive or coherent. I know it sounds boring, but just this is something that's just, you know, trying to please you every second of the way, and it just doesn't let up with that, and it can kind of wear you out after a while. The first film had the virtue, or one of its virtues, of I think like 92 minutes, whatever. It's pretty tight. This film at 104 minutes is still pretty tight, actually, by standards. And that works in its favor. But even so, you know, when you push the other side to 90 minutes, you can start to feel some scenes kind of wearing on you, that it just seems like arbitrary, or I keep using the word forced, so I won't use it again. But ways in which a film like this is so desperate to please, maybe there's an almost like quasi desperate quality to it in that respect. And for at least this viewer, I pull back a bit. Now, having said some things that were lukewarm to negative, I'll give a shout out to the PG-13 rating, in the sense that so many films today are gratuitously violent and obscene and really pushing. And sometimes if they get slapped with an R rating, or what I call sort of like a hard PG-13, it might sort of make parents wonder, you know, is this okay for the kids? I mean, that's a concern. But Tim Burton is smart that way. He knows this is really meant to be family entertainment. And so I think occasionally there might be something that makes you go, oh no, you know, or just, you know, kind of pull back. But there's nothing really that would warrant saying, well, you know, cover your child's eyes here. So I think that's actually an advantage nowadays, when the marketplace itself is tending to push pretty far towards on-screen violence and this and that. And I think, you know, a lot of the superhero movies, I mean, I know we're sort of inured to the violence, but when you think about the body count in some of those films, you know, and the kids are watching, and I'll sound puritanical here, but I think Burton's has that playful kind of childlike quality. And I think that's always been with him. So even like some of the imagery on its own might seem kind of grotesque, right? Like really extreme, but it's so goofy that you just find yourself giggling at it, you know? And so what do you think? It sounds like you giggled a bit.
Well, yeah, because I was agreeing with what you were saying. I like the, you know, bringing back together Danny Elfman and Tim Burton. That alone is worth the price of admission, just for, you know, something fun to watch. And I agree with you about the production design and some of the scenes, you know, like scenes where you have Jenna Ortega's character, you know, riding a bike, and there's a covered bridge, you know, it just sort of looks like small town Americana, but then it's got like a little sinister side to it, but it's not really sinister. It's really kind of kooky. So I think it's successful when it does that. And it's fun when it brings back things that worked in the first movie, like the tiny headed bureaucrats who are always afraid of everybody who comes in. I mean, some of the gags are really funny. Tim Burton really does have a very clever way of getting wit in.
Yeah, I love that use of the bureaucrats. They, you know, it's like, it's obvious, but so what that it's obvious? It's just that, you know, it's a funny setup there, and visually it's so engaging. And yeah, I was giggling too at that. And again, doubling back on this whole childlike sensibility, when you think about the house itself, that haunted house quality to it, and then the caricatures living therein in some cases. You know, it has that sort of Addams Family feeling to it. And Burton's done this throughout his career. When you think about, you know, some of those gothic or quasi-gothic touches, it has that Addams Family look. And you know, one of my favorite Burton films would be Edward Scissorhands. And when you think about the way in which this cookie cutter, nice, neat, contemporary suburb, meantime has this old gothic house in the middle, you know, that sort of sensibility is distinctively his. And I think this film is still able to mine that. It still has a lot of fun with it. Whenever I see a house like this, I expect to see Norman Bates any minute, you know? And I like that about it. It's a movie in that respect.
I like that. It's true. It does make you think about Norman Bates's house, and also the notorious house in the neighborhood, like Edward Scissorhands, where it's up on that hill and everybody knows that it's there. And there's all these stories about what goes on there, but nobody's really sure. So yes, it picks up all of those things, making it like a movie. One thing I thought was a missed opportunity was, because they do sort of lean into the Addams Family thing and the Wednesday Addams in particular, they don't bring in any sort of callback to Winona Ryder and Stranger Things, because it would have tracked. And it's also what a lot of people today know her for, not necessarily the original Beetlejuice movie. Another thing I thought maybe a missed opportunity, Mike, what do you think? Should they have had it open on Halloween?
Well, you know, this is an example of holiday creep. In other words, you know, by mid to late summer, at least in my neighborhood, I saw some people putting out Halloween decorations already. could be 90 degrees out and somebody's putting up their Halloween decorations. And so whether you're talking about mission creep or holiday creep, it's been happening commercially. And that's a whole soapbox opportunity in terms of how nowadays, rather than have these decorations go up, you know, a few weeks before the holiday, they go up a few months before it, and the stores are filled with the merchandise and so on. And let's just say that Hollywood's been known to do similar things. I'll give a very quick generic example that used to be back in the day, that the biggest releases of the year, the Christmas movies, really would come out in early to mid, and most often mid to late December. And then that holiday creep began some years ago, where increasingly the big Christmas movies were coming out by late November, early December. What happens when you cross that line with Thanksgiving? And around Thanksgiving, you start having what essentially are meant to be holiday movies opening. And so I think your observation's in alignment with that, in the sense that one would think that if you're going to have a Halloween type movie, you'd want to open it, you know, a week or so, or maybe 2 weeks before Halloween. Now we find things like that are opening probably in 2 or 3 weeks earlier still. So I think it's a larger cultural phenomenon there. And again, it's a matter of how it's like year-round holidays, if you will, because no sooner does one end than already the advertising, if you will, begins for the next one. So I think in terms of marketing, that's what happens. And I guess I'm just being old-fashioned that way, but, you know, I do get in the spirit of Halloween, but do I want to get into that spirit in late August or September, or maybe wait a little bit longer for it? Because really, after all, by late August, you went to the store and everything on the shelf was pumpkin spice, right? So there you go.
So there you go. Well, let's move on to a truly scary movie, The Substance. And, you know, this movie is so bizarre. Somebody asked me if it was weird, and I said, it's so far beyond weird that the light from weird isn't even going to get to it for eons. I know you've got an opinion about this movie, Mike. I can't wait to hear your thoughts. I've got a lot of thoughts, but I'll let you start us off somewhere.
Well, it has an intriguing premise. And without getting pompous about this, you know, there's a longstanding tradition, certainly in literature and elsewhere, of the doppelganger, the double, this whole sense of you have your identity and now here's another you. And there's so many permutations on it. It goes beyond doubling, I suppose, even. But this film's quite literal-minded about that, because here we have Demi Moore playing an aging actress who now is a fitness instructor with a popular show. And if you want to think about Jane Fonda, you can, but the film doesn't push that overtly. It's just a thought that occurs when you want to see the exercise videos that she's doing. But the point here is that she's getting of a certain age, and this is where we have to talk about the actors in terms of the real actors here. As you and I are talking now, Demi Moore is about to turn 61, so she's at that point where she's actually well cast here. It's a really good performance by Demi Moore, I'll quickly point out. And so the thing is, you know, she's reached that. People sometimes think I'm being cruel when I say this, but Hollywood has a cruel myth in terms of actresses in particular, what I always call the sell-by date. That, you know, when an actress gets to that point, only a handful have really fully survived that, if you will. It's kind of a mean-spirited way to describe it. But, you know, once you get to that point, do you still get the lead roles? Can you still have a romantic lead role? That's the big one. And I won't go further with that, or we'd have a 3-hour episode. but this movie actually, you know, in the casting, references that kind of thing. Now, I had hopes for this film, and I found it a really intriguing premise, namely the Demi Moore character, whose name Elizabeth Sparkle. How's that for a movie star name? Elizabeth Sparkle is losing her sparkle, I guess, and she's going to lose her show, and she wants to do something. And she finds out about this, and weird's the right word, or one words almost fail us as to how to describe this, but there's this formula that's available, and it's being commercially advertised within the film as, quote, a better version of yourself, close quote. And essentially what happens if you take this stuff, I don't even know what to call it, if you take this formula, somehow you can actually birth another version of yourself that's much younger. And without going into gory detail, and goodness knows the film goes into gory detail, the birth channel or canal or whatever isn't at the front, it's at the back, if you will. And so she gives birth from her back. And don't ask me to explain this from a medical standpoint at all, but she gives birth to this younger self. And then supposedly somehow they're meant to like switch off every 7 days. Now, here's where the film almost immediately fell apart for me. I like that premise, just conceptually. I think that's an interesting idea. But here's where it really starts to fall apart on so many levels. You can have a really extreme, really weird premise, but you need some degree of logic, of plausibility in terms of how you develop it. I always say that about sci-fi. You can have a really extreme premise, but you need something tethered to logical thinking to make the audience care. Because if anything can happen, nothing matters. So it's just totally arbitrary. So here's where it totally falls apart, because you would think in the premise there'd be an interesting idea of how this actress, Elizabeth Sparkle, will react to her new double, by Margaret Qualley. In other words, that's a really interesting idea. Like, you get to meet yourself at a younger age. Is it even that? I mean, you don't even know quite what to call this. And the younger self, the Margaret Qualley character, calls herself Sue. There's enough physical resemblance. You can sort of see how these are two aspects of the same person. But here's where it's really falling apart. You need to have some meaningful sense of how these two creatures relate to each other, how the real life actress that we spent time with early on, exercise videos in her apartment and so on, how she's going to react to and communicate with this new version of herself. The film gives that almost no real thought. It doesn't really have any definite notion of, like, what is this younger self and how would you talk to her and how would you relate to each other? And then even at the level, how exactly does this work? Somehow, like, every 7 days you switch off. I mean, it's just totally confusing at that point. And then where it's further, not just confusing so much as disappointing, is I kept wondering, and I know this sounds like a stick in the mud observation, but I kept wondering, what is the business model for this new miracle drug? In other words, in terms of the company selling it, offering it, presumably it comes at a price, a considerable one. Periodically, there are phone calls between the increasingly desperate Elizabeth and the company, and then you get this male voice at the other end. And that's okay to be a bit mysterious because it's ominous, like, who is this person running the company? And he tells you this, but doesn't tell you that. But still, you never have any sense of, well, how does payment handle this? How does this work? I mean, what's the business model? Again. And the film, it's so lazy and just so unthinking at this level that it just seems absurd beyond the ways in which it's probably meant to be absurd. So that was my major disappointment. It has that intriguing premise, and then I think really squanders it just by not, like, fully thinking it through at the basic scripted level. And then my second major reservation, and why I really turned against the film, was even if you're going along with it, it's much too long. And it's much too gross. It's 140 minutes, and you know, there are so many gross out effects. And you know, I sit through all kinds of movies, but even I at times thought, oh my goodness, you know, some of the stuff you see on screen. And I thought, how much of that is enough? I remember when the screening ended, I never, like, officially interview audience members, but I have good ears and I overhear things. And a young woman leaving the theater, she said, that was just too long. I mean, that was like her first comment. And I thought, yeah, like, enough is enough with it. And it's like so many movies nowadays where, and I think this is where special effects are a mixed blessing, because you can do all these things, you do all these things. And it's almost like they're back at the studio or in the lab. It's like, hey, you know what we could do? We could have the body do this or that. And it's like, yeah, let's do that. And it sounds juvenile, and I think it is actually. And so that was, for me, was like the real disappointment here. And so it just really, really doesn't make the most of what could have been an interesting film. At the level of production design, it's quite striking at times. And I think that there's a certain look or atmosphere that's achieved. And in terms of comments about mortality and aging and so on, you know, there are things in the film worth contemplating. And I had, you know, certainly well over 2 hours to contemplate them.
Well, I agree with a lot of what you said, especially about the gross out effects. I felt like too much carry at the end. And I could have done with half as much as what they showed, you know, less to be more. But I thought that the metaphor about your inner younger self was really very apt. And so I kind of thought that they were trying to say something a little deeper, because when Demi Moore calls, you know, the service and says, you know, she's not keeping the boundary. She's not keeping the boundary. And they remind her that, you know, the two of you are one. So she's like, what do I do? And they say, stop disrespecting the boundary to her. And that's when I started realizing, oh, this is about, you know, something like an older woman who can't accept that she is getting older, who insists on wearing clothes that are a little too young for her, or a hairstyle that's sort of out of date, because you can't let go. And it's you're the one doing it. You know, you can't really blame another person for it. It looks like you can, by the way the movie plays out, because you see two different actors. But in essence, they are the same person. And she is unable to not let the opportunities for her younger self take over, even though it's going to have disastrous results, which is just like, you know, extreme dieting or whatever else you want to, you know, liken it to. And I thought that was very, very well done.
See, it's an apt metaphor. I just don't think it works in the film at all. And yet another reason why it doesn't work, besides the ones I cited before, another reason I don't think it works is that, you know, Demi Moore, the other side of 60 looks terrific. I don't think she needs a younger self. and I think actually that, again, even though it's a strong performance, I think there's in effect like maybe too much vanity there. But what I'm getting at is, if she really were an aging actress and really showing that, there would be what I call mirror scenes, where you wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and like, oh Lord, I better put on some makeup today. But it's, when she looks in the mirror, she looks terrific. She looks great. So I know in Hollywood, there's great and then there's really great. But the thing is, you know, I think that spoils the film a bit. It sort of takes away from what should be the apt metaphor that you're talking about. And there's also like some other, whether intended or unintended, moments made me smile in terms of what aging means, particularly in Hollywood. So, you know, within the film, there's a TV executive who oversees that exercise show. He's the one who's going to fire her because she's getting too old and look for a younger replacement. And guess who that younger replacement will be on air? But he's played by Dennis Quaid. And, you know, this is where you do have to look at the actual ages of the real life actors, because Dennis Quaid is 70. So, but his character, the TV executive, Harvey, says at one point, after 50, it stops. And I thought, well, man, you know, you've had 20 years to contemplate that. And so, yeah, there are things like that, whether I'm meant to think about them or not. I think the film prompts that. I just think there needed to be more by way of what I call conversation between the older self and the younger self. Do you know what I'm getting at there with the Demi Moore character and the Margaret Qualley, much younger? What is she? She's sort of an offshoot of some sort. But this is why I wanted to pick your brain a bit more on this, because it seems to me that what you're saying about the apt metaphor, yeah, it's there, but wouldn't you have had a bit more of if not an extended sit-down conversation, like a little more give and take back and forth between the two of them? It's really not much. They don't really say that much to each other.
But I think that's part of the frustration between the character, because it's really a conversation with yourself. It's impossible. It's kind of like trying to communicate with your younger self that you know is within you. It's just, yes, you sort of can, because you can sort of remember the fifth grade, but you really can't talk to yourself in that way.
Yeah, but to push the point further, though, even if we're not going to have then that kind of dialogue between doubles, I would at least settle for a monologue. I wanted, you know what I'm getting at? I wanted it spelled out a bit more, because it is a quandary there as to how do you relate to your younger self. And so she could just be having her own thoughts. She doesn't have to even voice them. You know, it could be voiceover or just some sense of what she's thinking. It's not there. You can see the sort of desperation and panic in her face, but I think in a case like this, you need what I would call a more literary treatment of it. Since I mentioned literary antecedents for the double, you need some consideration of what are the consequences and how do you feel about this. And I don't think it's quite there in the film, at least in the scripted dialogue form.
All right, there's a couple of scenes that I want to bounce off you to see how they hit you. One is Dennis Quaid eating 2 kilos of shrimp, and just the sound design. I think the sound design in this movie is great, because it gives you the sense of just, I don't know, inner sickness, and like you almost want to throw up. It's scorchy sounds. It's just very wet and gross. The second is Demi Moore putting on makeup because she's going to go on a date. And she gets to the door, and then she sees a reflection of herself, and she goes back and puts on more makeup. And then she tries to leave and sees another reflection of herself, and she goes back and she puts on more makeup. And finally, she just smears it all around. She can't even leave the house. But the first time when she was ready to leave, she looked fine. She looked great. You see her just sort of fall apart, unable to reconcile the person that she is, who looks fine, with the person that she desperately wishes that she was, which she can't be. And the third thing, Mike, is the eyeballs. I mean, I will never forget this movie just because of the eyeballs.
Well, now you'll have me never forgetting it for that reason. But the second thing you cited, actually is, I think, one of the strongest scenes in the film, because with her value system, if you will, of how you have to look your best and look perfect and it's never quite good enough, her desperation there, because she looks fine initially. I would think, go out the door, you look great. But you know, she decides, well, I got to change the outfit or the makeup, and it just becomes frenetic at that point, and it's grotesque even. You know, like, let's smear this here and smear that there. And I was really moved by that, actually. I thought that was really a powerful scene. And perhaps with the first thing you cited, maybe there's a lot of gross stuff here, but I think maybe the grossest is when Dennis Quaid eats. And that's where the film does have, you know, it has good sound design throughout. And there you realize, I mean, he is a piggish character, but the way in which that's treated is just like grotesquely funny. And because like when he's making these pronouncements, you know, if he's eating a meal, we know exactly what he's eating because it's all in his mouth as he talks. And so bad table manners, yes. But just that's where the movie is like really almost surreal in its funniness. I mean, it's not ha-ha funny, but it's like queasy and gross funny in a case like that. And I thought, you know, the movie does have that sound design in its favor. You're right. Also, in terms of the overall production design, it presents this sort of brutalist Los Angeles where it's frighteningly contemporary. You know, it's like clean lines, but in the sense of sterile lines architecturally. And you know, apartments have a lot of bare walls and people are isolated in this space. And it actually in LA, very few people on the street, right? It really emphasizes that in a way that speaks to her mental condition. And I thought that was effective. I mean, I think the film certainly is guilty of overkill in all sorts of ways, but certainly the look of the film, and you're right, the sound of it. So that's not exactly a recommendation for the film, but you know, even though I think the film is disappointing at the basic level of scripting, I think in terms of realization, you know, it has some really, really striking moments. Sure.
Also, I like the pops of color, because you're right, it does kind of give you this very stark aesthetic, you know, blacks and whites, especially the bathroom and the place where you pick up the substance. But then you get this repeat color of yellow. And I love what they do with eggs to kind of give you the metaphor of splitting one person into two, but, you know, it came from the same original egg. And then she has that yellow coat. The substance itself, of course, is this sort of weird yellowy, toxic looking green. And then, of course, the egg yolks.
It's a sort of parlor game, you know? I mean, oftentimes watching a film, you look for those bits of visual cleverness in terms of where colors pop. And sometimes they pop in such gross and gratuitous ways that I wish they wouldn't. But you're absolutely right in terms of like that yellowish imagery that recurs in the film. So, there are some smarts actually in the filmmaking. I don't think it's a very smart film, but there's some smarts in the actual realization of it.
I also liked the anagram of Sue's name, where you just mix it around a little bit and now you have U's. I don't know if that was intentional, but I can only imagine that it was.
I would be guessing at that. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, because the film does have that kind of sensibility. It would do something like that. But boy, hasn't enough been done to poor Elizabeth Sparkle?
Now, I will say, love it or hate it, I think people are going to be talking about this movie.
I've been actually at movie theaters where, you know, other audiences were letting out from it, and it does engender conversation. And you can't say that for every film, right? So it's a film, whether you love it or hate it, you're going to talk about it. So that's not a recommendation on my part to go see it. But if you do go see it, blame Marie and then talk about it on the way out.
Yes, blame Marie. But I think everybody's going to get something out of this movie, if only because I think some of the ways things have been presented in this are just refreshingly original and creative. So I'm giving it very definite thumbs up. But again, sometimes we agree to disagree, Mike. But that brings us to the end of this episode. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.